thing.
Yeah, so let's start with a pleasure to have Eric Dorfer here, who's talking about exact half BPS states in type 2B theory.
Let me try to put this projector a little bit smaller. Okay, well, thank you. Should I just let it dangle like that? Okay. We probably need something more than that. So anyway, thank you for inviting me to speak in this physics and geometry seminar. Now, I noticed a few people have heard me speak last week, but it's not quite the same talk, although there is a little bit of overlap. So for those of you who were there last week, sorry for the things that are an overlap. So the title is the same, but I want here to give a little bit more mathematical emphasis on, in fact, a number of problems that I think can be quite interesting to mathematicians and as well to physicists. So this is work done in collaboration with John Estes, who is my student, and Michael Goodpearl, and there are a couple of papers here. And so supersymmetry, and this has been known for some time now, can be viewed as a problem in geometry. Supersymmetry from a mathematical point of view means that a certain manifold, possibly with extra structure, has some covariantly constant spinners, which play the role of the supersymmetry in physics. So for example, the way Calabi-Yau manifolds came into physics in 84 was precisely because if you look at, in that case, a heterotic string, and you want to compactify it on a six-dimensional manifold, and you want to preserve n equal 1 supersymmetry, or supergravity, then in fact you need one covariantly constant spinner on this C6, and that together with the fact that this space is Kähler and so on and so forth, leads you to the Calabi-Yau property. Now, so that's one case, and of course this has been studied quite a bit by mathematicians. And in the last few years, there is an odd dimensional version of this, which has also been studied quite a bit, which is Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, because, as I will tell you about in a few minutes, the compactifications of 10 dimensions, now, in view of the ADS-CFT correspondence, we want to have an ADS-5 factor, so the complementary manifold is five-dimensional. So, of course, there are no complex or Kähler manifolds in five dimensions, but there are Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, and their definition, in some sense, you could also think of as having a covariantly constant spinner. So the way I want to present the problem here today is basically we are looking for solutions to type 2B 10-dimensional supergravity, which preserve a certain number of supersymmetries. And, that number can be, from 0 to 32. The case of 32 is, of course, well-known, and sort of the next case, which has as many supersymmetries as possible, is 16. And from a mathematician's point of view, the novelty here, in a sense, is that we will be looking at covariantly constant spinners, but with an unusual connection. In fact, not with a standard connection at all. And we'll look at certain classes of manifolds, in fact, of this type. This ADS stands for hyperbolic space, typically with the Minkowskian signature, and then some spheres, one sphere or two spheres, and a warp product over a parameter space. And the interesting case here is when this parameter space is two-dimensional. Yes? Sorry.
What does the
warped
product?
It basically, I went in the wrong thing. It basically means that it's not a product, namely the radii, for example, of the spheres depend as you go along in this parameter space. Okay. So it's not a fiber bundle either, because we are allowing the sphere to go to zero at some point. Okay, so it's more like a vibration, if you wish.
Elliptic vibration, which can be singular.
But it's not elliptic.
Oh.
It's spheres and ADS spaces and so.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But
so
the spheres can also vary?
Yes.
Oh,
the
okay.
spheres and the ADS space all vary in radii.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll give you the formula in a moment. And in fact, I'll show you that this type of problem is actually part of a more general set of problems that... can you move back a little? Yep, thanks. Okay, so the motivation for this is from the ADS-CFT correspondence. How many pure mathematicians are here? One. Okay. Thanks for the SIFT for showing up. So this is a very small audience, so just ask questions anytime, right? Okay, well then for the mathematician Andreas, the motivation is the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is a conjectured map or equivalence between n equal 4 Yang-Mills on flat Minkowski space-time and type 2B string theory on this product of hyperbolic 5 space times the sphere. So this thing came out, I think, exactly 10 years ago, in late fall of 97, and have really revolutionized the field. 10 years ago, right?
Almost 10 years.
Yeah, that's right, right. In fact, there was some sort of festivity in Argentina,
yes.
I noticed, right. So this is an amazing correspondence because it maps a theory of pure Yang-Mills in flat space to a theory of gravity, namely, in principle, on curved spaces. So this is, of course, a huge subject. So the only thing I want to do here is sort of give you the key things about Yang-Mills theory and about type 2B string theory that we'll need. So here is Yang-Mills. So we're interested typically in an SUM on Minkowski space. And here are the fields, a connection, 4 vial spinners and 6 real scalars, all in the adjoint representation of SUM. And these numbers, 1, 4, and 6, correspond to irreducible representations of SU4. And the reason that group comes in is that, in fact, this theory is invariant under extended Poincaré supersymmetry. There are 4 vial supercharges Q, and their adjoints, Q bar, and they anti-commute in the following way, where P is the momentum operator. And so they map the fields in this way, right? And now you can see that this supersymmetry algebra has an SU4 automorphism group, and that's this SU4. Now this theory, if the scalar fields have 0 vacuum expectation values, then actually this theory is conformal invariant. Classically, but also quantum mechanically, the beta function is identically 0. And so we have the conformal group in 4 dimensions, which is SO2,4, or up to a factor of Z2 is also SU2,2. And because you have this conformal invariance, actually the commutators of the conformal generators with Q give you actually 8 new supercharges, so-called conformal supercharges. So instead of having only 8 supersymmetries, you really have 16, and these two groups, this SU4 and the conformal group, actually form the largest bosonic subgroup of this supergroup, SU2,2. The slash separates the bosonic from the fermionic fellows. So the thing, of course, has a Lagrangian, but we'll never need it, so I will spare you the details. So here is type 2B string theory now. That's, of course, a rather more complicated theory. It has 32 supersymmetries, and I'll show you the fields, the massless fields in a moment, but in particular, it has massless fields of rank 0, 2, and 4, which couple to D1 and D3 brains. D minus 1 is an instanton, and their magnetic duals, D5 and D7 brands. Yes?
So when you say of rank 0 to 4, does this mean two forms, four forms,
yes.
And then a couple mean I can integrate them over?
Yes, you can integrate them on these spaces. So here, D1, this is a somewhat odd notation, but you have to ask your colleague Joe in the physics department. The one actually means one space dimension. Mm-hmm. So space-time is really two, and the two form can be integrated on that, right? Mm-hmm. So now, these are the, so there are massless fields, of course that includes the graviton and so. Then there are massive string states, but they are very heavy. Typically, the scale is set by 10 to the 19 times the proton mass. And that is not an energy that we are going to reach very soon in accelerators. So in fact, if you're interested in low energies, low compared to this huge scale, then really only the massless states matter, and that approximation is called type 2b supergravity. And the advantage of it is that you can write it down in terms of local fields. So that's what I did here. So here is the supergravity approximation. So there's a metric in 10 dimensions. There's the axion dilaton scalars. These are the zero forms. There's a two form and a four form. And then there are also these fermions. And, well, there's some properties like the field strength of the five form has to be self-dual. So now, we are going to be interested in looking for supersymmetric solutions. So here are the equations that we, in this theory, that are the right equations for covariantly constant spinners. So they require that the variation of the fermion fields of these spinners is zero when the fermion fields as a background are zero. So these are actually equations for spinners, but the background is purely bosonic. And you notice a few things, is that the first equation is actually not a differential equation at all. It's an algebraic constraint. So this is unusual from the point of view of math. That's not an equation that normally comes in when you write down covariantly constant spinner equations. And the second equation, which is a variation of the Gravitino equation, involves the usual Levi-Civita spin connection, but it involves a phi-form and a tree-form contracted in this way. So it's not a connection in the usual sense. Okay, it's not an ordinary connection. So it gives mathematicians something to think about. And I think, you know, the object of mathematical study is actually to define this two-form in a mathematical way. And I don't think that's entirely successful at this point yet. So the four form and the five form are way off, and there's no real understanding. Mathematically, physicists, of course, know what to do. Okay, so now I need to know a little bit more about this ADS-CFD mapping. So the mapping is between the super Yang-Mills in four dimensions and type 2B string theory on this maximally symmetric manifold. And the correspondence goes as follows. The conformal group that I exhibited for you in the Yang-Mills theory is a global conformal symmetry. That symmetry of the two theories are the same must be corresponding to also a global symmetry on the type 2b side. And that symmetry is actually just the isometry of this hyperbolic space. Similarly, this SU4R, or automorphism symmetry, is nothing but the isometry of S5. And in fact, the supersymmetries also match. So these entire supergroups, in fact, match as a supergeneralization of isometry. And furthermore, when we discuss states with definite quantum numbers in the Yang-Mills theory, these states can be created by operators, so there is the usual field theory state operator correspondence, and each state, or each operator, if you wish, the expectation value of each operator, can be mapped to a supergravity solution. that's part of the correspondence. And there are even quantitative ways of comparing, you know, these expectation values, as these people here who are computing them in certain cases know. And so the cases of interest are certain operators, not the most general operators here, but those operators which have some residual supersymmetry by 16 supersymmetries. And so they will be mapped on the ADS side into solutions that have also 16 supersymmetries. So in fact, then, what we want to do is to solve the BPS equations. If you do this on the full theory, on the full ADS 5 cross S5, there are actually 32 solutions. And they fill out these 32 odd or Grassmann odd generators of this supergroup. So that's great. That's great that we have this correspondence in the case of ADS 5 cross S5. But that solution actually corresponds to the ground state of the N equal 4 Young-Mills theory. So we're interested in generalizing this to other geometries, other solutions which correspond to deformations of N equal 4 Young-Mills theory. And you can view that as Young-Mills theory with operators placed in it. Okay, that's one way to deforming a quantum field theory. So the simplest thing to do would still be to be interested in conformal invariant quantum field theories so that you keep this ADS-5 factor, but you can make the sphere more general. And in fact, you can replace this manifold by some general Sasaki-Einstein manifold if you want, depending on how many supersymmetries you want. So this is interesting, but of course the theories of the real world are not conformal invariant. So if you want to break conformal invariance and maintain only Poincaré invariance, then this ADS-5 is only an asymptotic property of the space, but not an exact property globally. Those cases are, of course, physically the most interesting, but since even if you have a lot of supersymmetry, this is actually still very difficult, and there are no exact solutions that are known. So we're going to be somewhere intermediate, and that's probably why we can solve. So we want to obtain general exact solutions for geometries with 16 supersymmetries on these warped spaces with these symmetries. So there is some conformal symmetry, but it's not as big as this one. And the first case, ADS-4 corresponds to, on the Young-Mills side, to a super Young-Mills with a planar interface, while the other one corresponds to super Young-Mills with a Wilson loop. So I'm only going to talk about the planar interface case. Last week I talked a little bit about the Wilson loop case.
Concerning this,
yes.
Aren't there known solutions for RG flows that go from A?
Approximately, I think. Approximately. I'm not aware.
This Pinch-Werner solution, for example?
Well, they're numerical. I don't think they're exact. Right? I mean, you know, they reduce the whole problem to...
5 dimensions.
Yeah, that's right. But it's not, you know, a fully exact solution. And similarly for, you know, Polchinski-Strassler,
yes,
for example, you know,
for sure,
they're approximately known, but not exactly. I mean, that may change. You know, I mean, I think it's possible that we find better techniques for, you know, getting these solutions. But RG flow is also, you know, it sounds more difficult, right? There is a non-zero beta function, so it does certainly sound more difficult. I'm not aware of any exact solutions in that case. Okay, so as I also explained last week, in fact, this problem can be viewed more generally as a special case of a more general collection of problems. You could ask whether you could construct all solutions with 16 supersymmetries in type 2B supergravity. That's probably very difficult, I would suspect, and would include some RG flow solutions. But we can be more specific and look at solutions that have an ADS-CFT dual interpretation. That's natural because we can view, on the Young-Mills side, we can view this as n equal 4 Young Mills with operators thrown in, that's like a perturbation of the original thing. And so we would expect, if we have 16 supersymmetries preserved, that there would be some subgroup of the full supergroup with 16 supersymmetries that's preserved. That's still hard, but if you make the subgroup semi-simple, then there is a finite classification. Yes?
For the first question, would that mean to construct all solutions for all possible space-time?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well,
not necessarily asymptotically ADS or anything.
Oh, all right.
Right.
And then by going to the second point, you kind of restrict the manifold
right.
you are looking at.
Okay. That's right.
Uh-huh. But right. For the first one, is it known that, at least in general, there should be a dual, a CFT dual for every general space-time?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there is anything. In fact, there are, on the Young-Mills side, there are Young-Mills theories that do not have an ADS dual. For example, there is a theory, which you probably know about, where you have n equal 2 super Young-Mills, but the number, and you add some fundamental hypermultiplets, and if you add their number to be twice the number of colors, okay, then, as we discussed, I guess, last week, then you get a conformal invariant theory, but it does not admit an ADS dual in any known way. Maybe there's some generalization, but for the moment it's not known. So those cases of a semi-simple subgroup, those cases, I believe, are actually accessible by some of these methods. The first one actually corresponds to the problem solved by Lin, Lunin, and Maldacena. And then there are a number of other subgroups, I guess, of this supergroup that enter here with corresponding spaces. And some of them are the ones we solved, but then there are a number of question marks that are open. Okay. So now I want to tell you a little bit more about these solutions. Actually, I do not want to go through the derivation of the local solution, because I did that last week. And also, so here I want to look a little bit more at the global properties of these solutions and the mathematical problems that are involved. So I'm only going to look at the theory with an interface and 16 supersymmetries. So that was the symmetry. The ansatz is for the metric is here. So Andreas, you see that what we call ds square, for example, of S1 square, this is the metric on the first sphere with unit radius. Okay. And then this F1 is a function which depends on this parameter space. So that allows you to vary, the size of these things as you go along through the parameter space.
So, but doesn't that mean that it's just the vibration over the sigma?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess, yes, this has become known as warped in physics for some reason. But, and then similarly, the tree form can be defined in terms of two complex one forms, curly G and curly H on sigma, and the phi form in terms of another real one form on sigma. And these volumes here are simply the volumes for these spaces with unit radius. Okay. And it shows some local coordinates, W on sigma, and I choose them to be conformal so that we just have an overall factor here. So now I showed you last time that in fact this can be reduced, the BPS equations can be reduced to an integrable system which can be integrated. And so here is the solution for the dilaton and for this scale factor of the surface sigma. And in fact, you can show that the type 2B supergravity field equations are automatically obeyed by this expression locally. Okay. And of course, there are all the other functions like F1 and F2, and so I'm not going to write them down. They're all in the paper if you really want to look at them. But they can all be written down. These are the key ones. So here is the local solution. Okay. So here's the local solution. And then, as I showed you also last time, you can actually recover ADS5 cross S5 and an immediate generalization of it, which is an interface theory. So here are the... Oh, sorry, I didn't say that in the last transparency. So the key is that everything can be solved in terms of two harmonic functions, H1 and H2, on sigma. And so all the other parameters, the dilaton, rho, can be written as functions of H1 and H2 in an elementary way. So in fact, as soon as I have these harmonic functions, then the solution is completely known. And so here is a solution in which the dilaton tends to one constant at one side and another constant at another side. If these constants are equal, then we have the ADS5 cross S5 solution. If they're different, then we have a solution where the dilaton varies, so the coupling varies across an interface, and this is now genuinely a different solution from ADS5 cross S5. So in fact, what I want to discuss mostly now is these regularity conditions for the global existence of a solution once we know the local solution. So how did we get to that? So of course we get to it to some extent by looking at what happened for ADS5 cross S5, namely the solution we know. And the observation is that the boundary, which is here the bottom and top boundaries of this strip, first of all, you can think of this as a single boundary, because you can think of it as going out to infinity and coming back, and then the two limiting ADS5 cross S5 behaviors are simply two points on this one boundary. And, right, I think that's all that I know. So, yes, I mean, we can observe that these combinations, these two harmonic functions are actually entirely positive on the inside of these, of this strip, and their product vanishes on the boundary. So this gives us some clue as to what to do. And so the regularity can... I don't know in general if I'm confronted with this kind of problem, how to solve this, I must say. Because I can clearly invent some sufficient conditions for a regular solution. But if you ask me, how do I know that I have all the solutions that are regular? I don't know how to solve that. Okay. So I'm going to adopt a set of criteria, regularity conditions, that seem reasonable to me, but I cannot show that, you know, that is exhaustive. So the regularity conditions we'll take is that basically all the physical data that come in the physical 10-dimensional metric and the dilaton and these one-forms that specify the anti-symmetric tensors, I'm going to assume that they're not singular on the inside of this parameter space. And we'll assume that on the boundary of the parameter space, they're non-singular except at isolated points. I want isolated points possibly to be singular, because even in the case of ADS-CFT, okay, some of these quantities actually become singular as I go out here. Like, for example, it depends on which coordinates I pick. But, for example, the radius F4 of the ADS4 will become singular as I go out here. That doesn't mean the 10-dimensional geometry is singular, but that's the way in which ADS4 sits in ADS5. So I need to allow for that. And as I argued here, this boundary is really a single boundary with these two points at infinity added, where these things can be singular. So I want things possibly to be singular, okay, at isolated points. Similarly, I think I will say that later, but similarly, I want possibly to incorporate d-branes in the probe limit, and that's again going to be sort of locally singular, and it's useful to do that. So that is another case where these data can be singular at isolated points. Okay, so after this spiel, and we tried actually numerically to put a pole on the inside of sigma, and so it doesn't work. I don't know. Maybe it's possible, but if you just put a pi, it doesn't quite work. And of course, I should maybe say also that you might think, well, the natural thing to try is a parameter space sigma, which is compact and has no boundary, but then you don't have any interesting harmonic functions on it. So that's a no-no.
So in the simplest case, you're taking this to be a disk. Is that correct?
Yes, you can think of it as a disk, and then you have two points at which the ADS5 would, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, that is, in a sense, the general case, because you can map a disk to anything with one boundary, and that's what I'm going to assume, that there's just one boundary. I think I have that one next. So regularity in... Yes?
Is there some residual symmetry acting on these functions?
Well, there is... you can, for example, interchange H1 and H2, mm-hmm. which amounts to S-duality in type 2b.
But I cannot, let's say, rotate them.
No, I don't think so.
So there's only a discrete symmetry?
Mm-hmm. As far as I'm aware, yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes?
Does it make sense to think about having orbifold singularities? Like singularities that are...
Inside sigma.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly. Yes, you could probably try to do that. We haven't thought about it much. But yes, I think you could probably do that. Okay, so then here is our attempt to at least make this thing regular on the inside. So e to the 4 phi, phi is a real field, this has to be positive, this quantity has to be positive, and rho to the 8 has to be positive too. They're actually positive under the same criteria, namely that, you know, these things have the same sign. So one set of manifestly sufficient conditions is that both H1 and H2 are positive, and then this inner product of their gradients is negative. The fact that I choose positive for both is immaterial. I could have chosen negative for both, or even one positive and one negative. They have to be uniform sign throughout the domain. That's the key point. Okay. So now we need regularity conditions on the boundary still. And let's see, so that I already said that the ADS 5 cross S5 asymptotic regions will have isolated singularities on the boundary, which correspond to regular 10-dimensional geometry, and in the probe limit of certain D-brains, that may also be singular on the boundary, so we want to retain these possibilities. So now I'm going to make some additional assumptions here, which I think, again, could be relaxed. So I view this more or less as a mathematical problem, actually, of regularity for these solutions that we know locally entirely, but not globally. So I'm going to assume that the only singularities on the boundary actually correspond to ADS5 cross S5 regions. Before, we had allowed isolated singularities on the boundaries, but now I want to be more specific, because I don't know how to solve that problem with arbitrary singularities. So we'll assume that. And then, in fact, these isolated points divide the boundary into segments. And we're going to then ask if the only singularity for these isolated points that on the segments, even though the segments are boundaries of the parameter space on the 10-dimensional manifold, this is interior points only. And finally, I'm going to assume that the boundary is connected and just has a single component. Okay. All right, so here, yes?
In the second case, in which you said the probe limit also has singularities on the boundary of sigma, those are still regular solutions from the 10-dimensional point of view, is that correct?
Yes. Oh, wait. You mean for the D brains?
Yes.
If I take them in a probe limit? Well, you know, it's the usual. I mean, if I have a D5 brain, there is a singularity as I go into the D5 brain. Right?
But, so there should be some parameter that tells you how many D5 brains you have.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If I take that to be large, then I have a large Bragg reaction.
Right.
And you're saying in that case, there's a smooth solution.
Yes. That's right.
So as I dial that parameter down,
mm-hmm.
presumably I always get a smooth solution.
Well, no, you see, you can actually dial it in such a way that you actually have a singular solution.
So there's some
which is not just the probe limit. Right, the probe limit would be when you just have one, let's say, right? Or when you have a D-fibrin, let's say, that has no back reaction on the geometry. But here, there's an intermediate case where you actually have a singular D5, which has large strength, in a sense.
But you can have that strictly solution. Singular, or is it just that the... So imagine I start with a large number of them. Uh-huh. I have a smooth solution, low curvature everywhere.
Right.
Now I start gradually decreasing their number.
Right.
So somewhere where I should think of their location, mm-hmm. curvature is going to start growing.
Right.
And it will grow a lot, but mm-hmm. Will it remain bounded if I keep the number finite, the number of defined frames?
Yes, it will. You can make it diverge. You can make it diverge even for finite three-form charge.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. So there's some critical value.
Yeah, it's basically, I'll show you the solution explicitly. It's basically, can I table your question for a moment? Yeah, but it's a very good question. In fact, one that I didn't address last week, so I will address it now. Okay, so here are all my assumptions, and I would love it if, you know, mathematicians, physicists, or whoever can lift some of them and tell me how to do this more generally. Okay, so basically then, the way our parameter space looks like now is this mustard type color here is the interior. We have a boundary, and then these points E, various E's, are the points at which we can have an ADS5 cross S5 asymptotic region. And at those points, that's what I already said. So we can map, in fact, any such domain with one boundary onto the lower half plane. So I'll do that. And then all these points are on the real axis. Okay, so now we want, however, that the segments in between the E's correspond to interior points of the 10-dimensional solution. The ADS4, by the very structure of the solution, can never shrink to zero. That's a simple fact. Okay. So the only thing that can happen is, in fact, that the S1s and one of the two spheres shrinks to zero. And that would be great, because then if I actually move to the boundary of sigma here, if one of the spheres shrinks to zero, then that can simply be, you know, blown up or completed into a piece of a tree sphere. So that means that either F1 or F2, which were the radii of these spheres, has to be zero on the boundary. Okay. So now, in fact, this can be solved because the form of the solution now implies the boundary conditions on H1 and H2. This comes straight out of the BPS equation, out of the solution. Okay, so I'm not deriving it, but you can look at it in the paper if you wish. So W is always this inner product value of the gradients of H1 and H2. And they're related in this way. And now you see that F4 is the radius of ADS4. It never vanishes. So, and it only blows up at infinity. So on the interior of these segments, F4 should be a regular function. And so if F1 vanishes, then H1 has to vanish. If F2 vanishes, then H2 has to vanish. So that means that if F1 vanishes, then H1 is actually zero on the boundary. Now, if H1 is zero on the boundary, then as I move away from the boundary, H1 is actually a good local coordinate, if you wish, because it's a harmonic function. And so, because W is zero on the boundary by this relation, then I can use H1 as a normal coordinate to the boundary. If W is zero, then that means that the normal derivative of H2 has to be zero. And vice versa. So in fact, we have two possible segments. Either a segment where H1 is vanishing Dirichlet and Neumann for H2, or the reverse. Those are the two possibilities.
Can you see when the time frame gets the normal derivative of H2?
Yes. So here, H1 is zero on the boundary. After all, I do have a blackboard. So H1, let's say, on this segment is 0. Okay. So now, of course, when I move away from the boundary, it's not 0, hopefully, right? Otherwise, it's going to be pretty dull. So H1 here is going to be positive by our assumption. So I can actually use H1 as a good local coordinate normal to this boundary. Okay. But now W is the... Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. For W being the inner product of H1, of the gradients of H1 and H2, then that means that the normal of H1, of H2 has to be 0. Okay, so now, in fact, in some sense, we've now linearized the problem, right? It was a horribly nonlinear problem. We've now linearized it and reformulated it in terms of two electrostatics problems, which are coupled because the segments are coupled the two problems to one another. Okay, so we've solved the boundary issue. Well, now we have to return to the interior issue, where we need to enforce that the harmonic functions are actually positive inside, and then their inner product is negative. Okay.
Why do you call it electrostatics?
Because I think of charges, you know, that are just sitting on the plane, right?
So it's not from the structure of the differential equation?
No. Okay. It's simply from the fact that harmonic function is a potential, right? Mm-hmm. And then if I require it to take on a certain value,
okay.
That's like saying it's on a conductor, mm-hmm. right? And if it's Dirichlet boundary conditions is a conductor, mm-hmm. Neumann boundary conditions is a perfect insulator.
Yeah. Right?
That's the way we... And then the charges just distribute themselves according mm-hmm. to the problem. Okay, so now in fact this problem can be solved by using some hyperelliptic functions or construction. So we map the domain onto the lower half plane, we'll call the coordinate u, boundary is a real axis, the points ei are the points at which we switch from Dirichlet to Neumann for a given harmonic function. And that number has got to be even, obviously. So now the way you construct, we will construct not the harmonic functions directly, but rather their holomorphic differentials. Curly D here stands for the 1,0 form, which is the holomorphic differential. So in other words, we construct the electric fields before we construct the actual potential. So what we need here is to alternate Dirichlet and boundary and Neumann boundary conditions for the electric field. So that means that on one segment, the electric field will be perpendicular to the boundary, and on the other part, it will be parallel, corresponding to a conductor when it's perpendicular, or an insulator when it's parallel. Okay. So the way to do that, of course, is to introduce a function that can take purely real and then imaginary values depending on crossing across these various points E. And the way you do that is by defining this polynomial. Okay, and here I have ordered these these things will be branch points. I've ordered them in this way. So the square of S changes sign as U moves along the real axis and crosses the points EI. So its square root then alternates between real and imaginary on the boundary. So a natural differential would be DU over SU. That would exactly have the properties that it alternates between real and imaginary. Okay, but it doesn't have the proper asymptotics at these branch points. Remember, at the branch points, I want to recover ADS5 cross S5 regions. And if I use this, this in fact is a holomorphic differential at these branch points. So it doesn't have a singularity, and the ADS regions being non-compact, I need to have something that has singularity. So in fact, the right thing to do is to not consider du over su, but actually du over su to the cube. And then at each of the branch points, this has the right singularity to guarantee a local ADS5 cross S5 region. Now, the point at infinity is another branch point, remember, that was part of the construction. So we can put up here a polynomial, and in order to preserve this alternating real and imaginary property, these polynomials have to be real. That's why I put the I in front here. The minus sign, I forgot why that was there. But. So if these polynomials are real, then these electric fields have the property of alternating imaginary and real along as I cross the real axis. Okay, and that we have. And since there one of them is Neumann and then the other is Dirichlet, their inner product is automatically zero on the boundary, and so W is automatically zero. We've realized that automatically. Okay. Now the only thing left is the degree of these polynomials. That's dictated by the fact that infinity is a branch point. So we need again to have this behavior, but now at infinity, and that dictates that the degree of the polynomials is 3g plus 1. So now we have all this, but we still need to enforce regularity on the inside. In particular, we need to enforce W negative on the inside and these harmonic functions positive on the inside. And then the only thing I've guaranteed here is that we had Neumann and Dirichlet conditions, but we actually need the fields to satisfy vanishing Dirichlet conditions. Not only should H1 be a definite value on the segment, it should be zero. Okay, that's a stronger condition, which I will call vanishing Dirichlet conditions. So let me go through a few steps here of some of these things. So W negative on the inside. Well, what does that mean? Well, the polynomials P1 and P2 are real. So their zeros can be either complex pairs or real. So, actually, the first thing is that if you have a complex zero of P1, let's say, then it has to be a complex zero of P2 of the same order. Because if that doesn't happen, and you take the product of these two electric fields here, okay, so suppose this has a zero but this doesn't, then basically in the neighborhood of this zero, in the middle of the parameter space, this function cannot possibly stay of the same sign. Because you circle around one, you circle around the zero in the complex plane, all values are assumed locally, all signs are assumed. So for that reason, in fact, if you have a complex zero, then it must be common to both polynomials. So in fact, then, let's pull out all the complex zeros. Let's call them UA from 1 to P. So we'll pull them out. So now the form of the differentials is like this. Where this PU is common, these are all the complex zeros. And then the Qs contain zeros that are purely real. So now these polynomials were of the same degree. The Ps are the same. So Q1 and Q2 have the same degree, actually. And so we'll call their zeros alphas and betas ranging from 1 to q. And there is a relation, obviously, that the total degree, which is 3g plus 1, should be the sum of these two degrees. Okay, so that's a rather strong condition on the complex zeros of this. So now we still need to enforce a condition at W be negative everywhere. And you can see that this now reduces to a condition that the imaginary part of Q1 of U times Q2 of U bar be positive, actually. Now, it takes a little thinking, but actually, this can be solved in a unique way by giving a relative order to the zeros. So they have to alternate, essentially. We chose them ordered, we can always do that, and this condition is uniquely solved by having this order. And that gives you all solutions to the equation, too. Okay, so that now we've guaranteed that W is negative. Now we still need to guarantee that H1 and H2 are positive everywhere. Well, everywhere, in particular, means near the branch points. Right? You can linearize around the branch points and check. And in fact, that tells you that these real polynomials evaluated on the branch points either have to be positive or negative. Okay. And in fact, you can even enforce the condition that H1 and H2 is, suppose you have an interval where H1 is 0 here. Well, now I can enforce the fact that H1 is positive in the neighborhood of this. That's again a problem you can solve. And this gives you slightly stronger conditions than the ones I wrote down here. And you can solve all those conditions uniquely and completely by ordering, giving a relative order to the zeros of Q1, Q2, and the branch points. And amazingly enough, they exactly fit in together in that one way. Okay. And that gives you all the solutions of this, in fact. I could show it to you, but it takes a while to do. So in fact, we've now completely solved the conditions that W is negative in the inside, and that H1 and H2 are positive, at least in the neighborhood of these intervals. Okay. The fact that they are positive everywhere, well, in specific examples you can actually show explicitly by the explicit solution. And more generally, there is an electrostatics argument, actually, which, you know, that this is true. So, anyway. Now, the one thing we haven't ensured yet is that actually that the Dirichlet conditions are vanishing Dirichlet conditions. The way you do that is as follows. So we now have on the boundary, here is the boundary. So now we have a number of these segments. So here is a segment where H1 is 0, here is a segment where H2 is 0, here is a segment where H1 is 0. That's what you want. Now the only thing you've guaranteed is that H1 here and H1 here are constant along this segment. That's what Dirichlet means. To guarantee that they are vanishing Dirichlet, it suffices to say, well, let this one be normalized to 0. I can always do that by subtracting a constant. Then what I need is the contour integral of dH1 from here to here must be 0. Actually, the imaginary part, I think, is right. Right, because then I guarantee, well, if H1 is 0 here, then the increase in H1 is calculated by this integral. And if I guarantee that that's 0, then in fact it follows that H1 is also equal to 0 here. So that gives rise to these 2G line integral conditions. And, I think that's pretty much what I wanted to say here. So what is the meaning of these things? Well, the best way to interpret them is that if I give you the branch points and these real zeros of the polynomials, then you can think of these sets of equations as the equations for the complex zeros of these two functions. Okay, they're exactly the right number. And so now the question is, well, do these equations actually admit a solution? Okay. And that's an interesting mathematical problem. This problem, in a sense, is the problem of what if the moduli space of the solutions. I've given you already a big chunk of it because I told you how to order. The ordering here of the real zeros and the branch points gives you, you know, a partial solution. But now you still need to solve these equations. And if you have a description of the general solution of that, you have a description of the moduli space of all solutions. So this is comparable to constructing, you know, the moduli space of, let's say, monopole solutions or instanton solutions. Okay, I think it's a very interesting mathematical problem. Yes.
Why is it imaginary part? Why not real part?
D is a complex object.
Correct.
Right.
So
right.
So dx minus I x dy, right? This is it.
Let's
see. You want to integrate out of the real axis.
Right. Okay, I can look it up. I will look it up after. after the seminar. I brought the paper with me. It should be D, let's see, D.
Is it maybe because these functions are harmonic?
Yeah, but I, okay. Yeah, it's a matter, it may be a matter of convention, actually, right. Okay, let's see. So, yes, so for the case of genus 1, oh, yeah, okay. So here, let's see, topology of regular solutions. How much time do I have, by the way?
Till 5:30.
Oh, okay, well, I will not go that long. Okay, so basically now, so what is the topology of these solutions? So there are 2G plus 2 branch points, which correspond to asymptotically ADS5 cross S5 regions, which are all distinct. In particular, they have a distinct independent constant dilaton value. And you can count up the number of free parameters of the solution, and it's 4G plus 6, but this is, in a sense, the dimension of the moduli space, real dimension. And I think, as I had shown you also last week, there are actually G-independent pairs of homology tree spheres, which you can think of in the following way. Here is a segment where the second two-sphere vanishes, and here is another segment. So if I have a curve that goes between these two, then I have a two-sphere that vanishes at both ends, and that's a tree-sphere. So that's how these things come about. And in fact, these spheres in groups carry Neuville-Schwarz tree-form charge or Amor-Amor tree-form charge. So the fact that these charges can be non-zero, of course, in the ADS5 cross S5 case, these charges were zero. In the supersymmetric Yanov case, these charges were still zero. But now here, actually, for genus 1 and higher, we actually have non-zero charges here. And this, in a sense, reveals the underlying nature of the solutions that we have, because these charges are characteristic of D5 brains and NS5 brains. So these solutions are, in fact, fully backreacted D5 and NS5 brains in this ADS5 cross S5 background geometry.
So these fluxes count in appropriate units the number of D5 brains.
Yes.
NS5 brains.
Right. Although, of course,
who's backreacting?
Yeah, because of course you could always have a D5 brain with a multiple charge. So here, I mean, you know, this would add up if you had several D5 brains, right? It would. Well, no, I'm sorry. You do it on one cycle. If you do it on one cycle,
yeah, right.
It's the charge of that particular D5 brain.
Right.
That's right. So if you added the contribution from all the cycles, that would give you the total number of D5 brains with their charges.
Right. So right. For simplicity, let's suppose we look at a case where I only have charge or flux through a given cycle.
Uh-huh.
Then that flux is telling me the number of D5 brains, for example,
mm-hmm.
and the solution is regular,
mm-hmm.
if I understand mm-hmm. correctly, for any value of that flux.
Yes.
Large
mm-hmm.
or small.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, but in particular, for a very small flux, I should be near the probe.
I'm going to come to it.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. I haven't forgotten your question. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I think the correct statement here is that for every assignment. Well, there is always, of course, the issue of what the global moduli space is, which I do not know for all, you know, for all genera. So is it conceivable that for very strange assignments of the charges, there is no more solution? That's not something I really know for a fact. See what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because there is some issue of, you know, what if the... Right. What is the global nature of the moduli space of these solutions? Now, actually, I think I do have the argument. Yeah, I think the right statement is for any assignment of these charges on all of the cycles, mm-hmm. there will be a regular solution.
Right.
Okay, but I can also take a singular limit of it, which I'll show to you in a second. Yeah. Okay, so I think I explained that. Okay, explain that. So let me actually give you the genus one solution in some detail so you can have an idea of what's going on. So remember that for genus one, there were two real roots here for Q1 and for Q2. Here is the definition of the curve, and here is the, this should be a 1 here, U bar 1. This is the contribution of the 1 complex 0, and this is the ordering of all these points. Okay. So now basically, the vanishing Dirichlet conditions that I had here, there is one of each, so there are two relations. And they take the following form. You see, they arise because you integrate something that's linear in P. So in fact, they will naturally be a quadratic form in U1 and U1 bar, but with real coefficients, in fact. So you get the two equations that correspond to this actually are these, A0, A1, and A2. And B0, B1, B2 are real coefficients, which are given, I wrote down only the A's here, are given like so. The alphas are the real roots. The E's are the branch points. Q1 is this polynomial. Zeta is the Weierstrass zeta function on the half period, divided by the half period. And these capital E's are some combinations of the branch points. So these things, these coefficients, yes?
Where do the periods come from?
It's a convenient way of writing it. So if I have the branch points,
I go back to the
rectangle, so essentially, and extract the periods.
So there is a torus.
Yes.
We are having some way here.
Yes, that's right. It's a rectangular torus.
Oh, okay.
There was one real period and one imaginary period. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, these coefficients you see have ratios of branch points, which means that they're essentially modular forms. Okay. Except that this object zeta I, this is not a modular form. This is a modular connection. So in fact, these coefficients are really, really modular connections. Connections in the sense that under a modular transformation, they will transform with an inhomogeneous piece to it. So these are the two equations. And so these equations actually then tell you that there is a solution. Remember, these are the equations that tell you about the position of U1. So each of them is, I guess my circle's not very good, but each of them is a half circle on the real axis. And so if there is a solution, if these two circles intersect, and then the corresponding complex zero is that intersection point. So basically now the problem of the moduli space for genus 1 becomes, when do these two circles intersect or not? Okay. And, I don't know. So here it is. You can solve it. It's a bunch of inequalities, essentially. You have to require that the radii square are positive and that they intersect. But it's a rather complicated set of equations, you know, which are given by modular forms, so modular connections. But anyway, I mean, you know, there is an explicit form for it. It's just rather complicated. And you can actually show in various limits. For example, you can take the limit of a square torus, and then these formulas all simplify tremendously, and you can show analytically that there are, you know, genuine solutions. Okay. Okay, so here I think I showed you this picture last time. So in the genus 1 case, there are the four asymptotic regions with their dilaton positions of the S5s and of the two S3 cycles that we have.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yes.
So is there a locus on this solution where you putatively could say that the D5 range or the nth migraines lie?
In some sense, along these two tree spheres, right? Because that's where you could think of localizing the flux. So you can think of this as one D5 brain and one NS5 brain, uh-huh. and then the charges of them are those flux two fluxes through, through these different trees. Yeah.
Three cycles that link.
That's right. Right. Okay, let's see. I did this last week. Does anybody want to see this again? Topology change?
I wasn't able to make it here.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, then I will do it for you. And, you know, the others can complain to you after. So basically now, you know, we have now a large family of solutions indexed by the genus of this hyperelliptic surface, okay? But in fact, these, and so each for each genus there is a dimension of the moduli space, and of course I've shown you only the solution for genus 1 explicitly. For higher genus to genus 2, we actually numerically also worked out that, you know, there really are solutions, because you could wonder whether, you know, there are, but and genus 2 and genus 3 we actually worked out. And I'll give you an argument later that there should be solutions for all genera in some open set with that dimension. But in fact, you can also have topological transitions between different genera. So, you know, it's not as if these solutions are completely disjoint sets of the moduli space is really reduced to one another. So that's what I wanted to show in this transparency here. And the way you affect this topology change is by collapsing one of the branch cuts. So here I've picked the branch cut, and I've also shown you in the neighborhood of this branch cut how the different zeros of these things are ordered. And then here I wrote the differential of H1 and H2 as a function of what happens in this little yellow square, this factor and that factor, and then everything else is dh1 of one lesser genus and dh2 of a lesser genus. And now you can fairly well follow what's going on. For example, if this branch cut goes to zero, then automatically alpha I converges also to that point. And that means that, in fact, there is a cubic zero in both of these functions, but this also gives you a cubic pole, I guess I should say, but this also gives you a single zero, so that reduces the order of the pole to just two. But now there's an additional piece that one can show, is that one of the complex zeros actually comes to this interval as it collapses. So that means that this entire coefficient here becomes 1. On the other side, it depends on what beta does. If one of the betas also goes to this interval, then in fact that entire factor also disappears, and you really have topology change across from one genus to one lesser genus. But you do have the option of keeping this beta away from this collapsing branch cut. Okay. And when you do that, then you see there is in fact a pole left here. It's still true that this U descends here, but there is actually a pole that's left, a single pole in one of the two functions. Okay. And this corresponds to a singular limit. This is not quite the probe limit yet, because the residue of that pole does not go to zero. In the probe limit, you would expect that, right, the number or the charge on the brain really goes to zero. But that's not true. The residue remains finite here if you want it to. Depends on how you take the limit. And so this, in a sense, gives rise to a singular D5 or NS5 brain that remains.
So it's not clear what the physical interpretation is.
No. I think that's right. And in fact, you can now play a game which is to let all branch cuts collapse. Since you've done one, you can make all of them collapse. And that means that Of course, there would be a trivial solution in which I just recover ADS5 cross S5 by the argument I just gave you. But if I actually kept the poles at each for each branch point that I collapse, then I obtain this simple solution now, for which I can write down not just the differentials of H, but actually H explicitly in terms of logs. Again, makes you think of electrostatics, right, in two dimensions. The log is the electric potential. And now on this solution, this is now a singular solution because each D5 and NS5 brain enters, in fact, in a singular way, but with finite strength, not with infinitesimal strength. Okay. But in fact, you can show that except for this singularity, this solution satisfies everything you want. Namely, you know, all the regularity conditions that we had are satisfied, except that they have these singularities at the points where these D5 or NS5 brains sit. Okay. And these residues here are actually related. Remember, the curly F and curly H were the Rameau-Rameau and Novoschwarz-Novoschwarz three-form charges. So they're simply related to this. And the Ks and the Ls give you the positions of these things. W actually here, I should say, is not in the half plane. It's in a quadrant for reasons I don't want to explain. Now actually, since this is after all a math talk, right? How do I know that there are solutions to all genera? This is something that kept us, you know, and are there solutions with that many moduli, or is the set actually smaller? So a physicist's proof of this, I think, would go something along these lines. We know that this singular solution we can show satisfies all the criteria for all genera and all assignments of charges. Okay. And in fact, you can now go back and take this singular solution and blow up each of the poles into a small branch cut. Okay. This is local. This is completely a local operation and shouldn't depend on any of the other, you know, branch points or whatever that are present. And so in fact, you can regularize this singular solution sort of step by step and make every single one of these poles smooth, okay, by making it into a branch cut. And then you have a flux solution that has no singularities, but the same amount of flux. Okay. So, and in fact, when we looked numerically, we sort of looked, you know, close to these topological transitions, because we knew that at lower genus there was a solution. So let's take that solution in an open set and now show that I can, you know, supply more parameters by opening up a branch cut and then have just as many parameters as you claim. So that's how we went about it numerically. But you can also do that analytically, I'm sure. So anyway, if there were a mathematician's proof, I would suspect it would go something along these lines of actually blowing up these, you know, poles.
But don't you have to show that in the process of blowing up, mm-hmm. you can actually control the, I don't know, some derivatives so that you will still be close to a solution?
Yeah, but I think in a sense, that's what I meant here by this thing is local. So the local model for it, you can take it to be the genus 1 curve, for example.
Oh, and you know what?
And you know that the solution exists there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. Right, you know that the solution exists there in an open neighborhood, uh-huh. right? So not just at that point, actually in an open neighborhood with that many moduli. So that's why I think this is correct, even though it's a physicist's proof. Okay, so, well, I think I explained this last time, but I don't want to keep you too long. So the ADS-CFT interpretation is that of an interface theory, but in which, in fact, instead of having just one species of N equal 4 theory ending, you have G plus 1 on each side. And that's something we're still, you know, working out the details of, but I think that's probably the right interpretation. And okay, so then here I think are, to my mind, some of the most interesting mathematical problems is actually what is this moduli space, even for genus 1, but, you know, especially for higher genus. These equations with their modular connection coefficients, I'm sure, are some meaningful equations mathematically. Okay. And then I think from a physics point of view, also important is, are there actually regular solutions with other different, you know, with other 10-dimensional topologies? Thank you.
Thank you very much for this great talk. Are there any questions?
Yes.
Going back to the slide where you had the frequency with four functions.
This one? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to visualize the geometric transition by looking at the T cycles, like one of the cycles boxing the other?
Yes, that is an interesting idea, an interesting question. Actually, if you look at the genus 1 solution, it can degenerate in two ways. Either by letting two of these things become very thin and basically disappear. You would do that by taking the residue of these branch cuts. Well, it's not a residue mathematically, but you know, the strength of these branch cuts go to zero. You can do that. But interestingly enough, there is actually another way in which you recover the genus zero solution, and that is basically when there is an identification between this side and that side and this side and that side. Namely, in some sense, you can recover it as an orbifolding by a Z2 of a genus 1 solution. And that's actually the first genus 1 solution we found by accident. So, and that must also exist for higher genus, but I don't know exactly how that happens. So it would be, in a sense, a case where somehow this disconnects in the middle here. If these, right, so you can imagine that this boundary here sort of goes in, and then ultimately disconnects in the middle, and then you take the orbit. I mean, you identify then the two copies that you have. That's right. But the simplest, of course, is simply when these two shrink to, you know, nothing.
I was asking about the red and the blue cycles.
I'm sorry, you should have stopped me earlier. Yes. Okay, sorry. Say that again.
Is there a transition between, say, either having the red cycle collapse or the blue cycle collapse?
It's the same transition. It's the transition to genus zero.
Okay.
Right. But I think you cannot collapse the one without collapsing the other. I think that's right.
So if you have this solution dual to this n equals 4 theory, just with a defect corresponding to the intersection between D3s and D5 frames, that gives you hypermultiplets localized on the defect coming from the 3-5 strings?
Say that again?
Yeah, so we started with ADS 5 plus 5, which is dual to n equals 4 theory, and 3 plus 1 dimensions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I could construct an ADS CFT duality between, if I take instead of D3 brains to start with, I take D3s intersecting D5s along a 2 plus 1 dimensional common.
Right.
So that gauge theory is n equals 4 propagating in 4 dimensions, coupled to hypermultiplets in the fundamental of the gauge group, localized on the intersection.
Right.
Because those come from the 3-5 strings.
Right. That's
okay,
right.
So that's my gauge theory.
Yes, that's right.
So that should be dual to some of these geometries.
Yes.
One of these.
Right.
Where I only have flux through some cycle associated to the presence of the 5 brain. Because I have incorporated their back reaction into my original idea. Now, so what solution is that in this whole class that you presented? That would be my first question.
It's the solution. If you can have a solution which has a 3-cycle but no charge on it.
Okay.
Right. But charge on the other one.
Okay.
So that would be...
So that's that solution. I'm confused about how many asymptotic ADS regions it has, because I would expect that I should have a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory with a single defect in the middle. So it's just plain with...
Right. I understand what you're asking. Right.
How many?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's something we're still trying to figure out. Actually, that's why my transparency there was, because indeed, for example, if you have, right, there is a theory from the Yang-Mills side. There seems to be a theory with 16 supersymmetries, just a planar interface, and nothing on the interface, no hypermultiplets on the interface.
Okay.
Which has, you know, 16.
But that's not the one I want.
Right. Well, the other one, interestingly enough, I'm not sure where it is here.
I see.
I'm not sure where it is, because it's something we're trying to figure out. In fact, keeping us confused. In particular, when you do this decoupling that you were asking about before,
yeah.
Right? Suppose I have these. These bifundamental hypermultiplets here,
mm-hmm.
and which are sitting only at the interface, and I now decouple two of these regions, then...
Well, let me say, those hypermultiplets mm-hmm. are in the gauge theory.
Right.
You don't see them.
Right, you don't see them directly. Right. No, you do not see them directly. Right. Right.
But in fact, this mm-hmm. is related to another question I had, which mm-hmm. is, when you have these hypermultiplets,
mm-hmm.
there is a global U and F
mm-hmm.
symmetry
mm-hmm.
that rotates one hypermultiple into another.
Right.
If you have NF of them.
Right.
Just a flavor symmetry.
Right.
Now, that should correspond to a gauge symmetry in your solution.
Right.
And in the probe limit, I know what that is, because if I have NF D5 grains in ABS,
mm-hmm.
on the world volume of my NF D5 grains, I have a gauge symmetry. Which is dual to the global symmetry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But when you include the back reaction, remove the D5 grains as
mm-hmm.
objects, I don't know where that symmetry goes.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a symmetry that's here, right? In this, that's right. Yeah, I mean, all these questions are extremely good questions, the ones that have to do with these hypermultiplets on the interface. And it's keeping us still confused, I must say. Yeah. Right, because also you would think in one of the geometric transitions, then on the Yang-Mills side, how can I go from a case where I have these, you know, interface hypermultiplets to a case where I actually don't have them anymore? So, of course, as you say, on the ADS side, you do not observe these things directly.
Mm-hmm.
But on the Yang-Mills side, however, how does that work? Okay. It's confusing. I don't know the answer. But that makes it interesting, I guess, right? it's not a straightforward interpretation. That much I can say, right?
Any more questions? Well, let's swing there.
Okay, thank you. I don't know how it works.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.